What I'd like to tell you a little bit about is our efforts as a group of soybean breeders and people interested in resistance to soybean rust to try and identify germplasm that's resistant to this disease and could be a potential source of resistance genes for breeding programs. So, most of you probably know this information, but I just want to lay down a basic bit of knowledge. It's caused by Phacopsora pachyrhizae, and it's spread primarily by, entirely by wind-borne uridineospores. And this is important because these can move very long distances when conditions are right. So, as Ray mentioned before, the disease can really be explosive when you've got large numbers of uridineospores, the right conditions for those to germinate and infect plants, and certainly when you've got wind that can carry them long distances. Phacopsora is an obligate biotroph with more than 100 known host species. So this is important in the U.S. because it can only survive in areas where there's little or no frost during the winter. So unlike parts of Brazil where the soybean growing regions are frost-free year-round, in the U.S., most of the host plant material gets killed back. It can move northwards, we know, at least as far as Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana, and they're finding spores quite a bit farther north from those states, but apparently the conditions aren't right or the spores are not surviving well enough to germinate once they arrive beyond that so far. The epidemiology and infection potential, as Ray mentioned, are highly dependent on environmental factors such as moisture, temperature, and the amount of solar radiation that the spores are exposed to before they arrive to their final destination. They're sensitive to certain frequencies of light, so that reduces the germination of large numbers of the spores that are exposed to sunlight. These are just some photos. I think most of you have probably seen similar photos before, but these are uridineospores with, in the photo on the right here, you can see there's a sort of chimney or volcano-type structure that emerges from the leaf surface, and the spores are produced from the end of that in this structure opening called an ostiole. This photo shows a field in Quincy, Florida in 2006. I wasn't involved in this research, but I was very impressed by the black and white differences you can see between the no fungicide treatment on the left versus a fungicide treatment on the right. This work was actually done by Tristan Mueller, who was a grad student with Glenn Hartman at the time working in Quincy. This map is a few weeks out of date, so rust actually has moved a little bit further northwards than what you see here. But as you can see, it's already gotten up. This is on 22nd of October. It's already gotten up into Iowa, southern Illinois, and Indiana. So once the environmental conditions become favorable for the pathogen, then it can move very long distances. So trying to evaluate resistance to soybean rust is a real challenge, largely because of this environmental influence. So this influences both the development of the disease locally and also the epidemiology on a research station and also in the region. The stage of plant development is important because we know that a lot of times symptoms don't show up until plants start to reach their maturity. So we have to be careful that we don't mistake late maturity for what we think is resistance. And this is complicated by the 13 maturity groups of soybean, especially trying to screen germplasm and trying to do it in one location. Again, we need to be careful that we don't mix up maturity with what appears to be resistance. Also, there are potential geographical and temporal variation among isolates of the pathogen. and across the southeastern U.S. And from year to year, we don't know what spores are blowing in from further south, from Mexico or potentially again from South America. And also, we need to be careful that we don't mistake lesions or damage that's done by other pests or pathogens for rust lesions. If the rust lesions are sporulating, it's generally very clear that it's rust, but sometimes the immature rust lesions look very similar to some other diseases. So this year, we conducted germplasm evaluations in 7 different locations in 5 states. And so this was a major effort, really led by Randy Nelson, who organized people in these different states with different institutions to conduct germplasm screening in Bossier City in northwest Louisiana, Alexandria in the middle, Baton Rouge, a little bit north of here, Fairhope, Alabama, down near Mobile on the Gulf Coast, Quincy, Florida, and just a little bit further north in Attapulgis, Georgia, and then up in Blackville, South Carolina. So these are some of the people who were involved with these germplasm screenings, including Emerson Scheip and John Mueller from Clemson, who are working at Blackville, Roger Borman and Dan Phillips from the University of Georgia, working down in southwestern Georgia at Attapulgis. In Quincy, Florida, I was collaborating with Glenn Hartman, David Wright, and Jim Marois. Glenn Hartman's with the USDA ARS also, and David and Jim Marois are with the University of Florida. David Weaver from Auburn, working in Fairhope. Ray Schneider from LSU. Also Steve Moore at Alexandria and Blair Buckley up in northwest Louisiana in Bossier City are also from LSU. And again, Randy Nelson was really the person who did most of the work in coordinating these efforts and also providing seed to the different people at the various sites. So our evaluation strategy is really to try and synchronize plant maturity or the growth stage of the plant in terms of reaching the reproductive stages with the late summer, early fall rust epidemic that we generally see here in the southeast. So this is a time when the hot summer temperatures and the dry weather is dissipating, the nights are becoming cooler, a lot of regions are starting to get more precipitation than they had previous to that. So one thing that we're doing is to plant relatively late. And depending on the site, this was between late July and early September. And that's to try and delay the maturity of the plants again to this fall period when the rust epidemic starts to take off again. Another thing we did at several of the sites was to extend the photo period using portable lights. And I'll show you some photos in a minute. And to try and reduce the bias of scoring plants from different maturity groups. At several locations, we grouped these into tests based on the maturity group of the plants. So this is a summary of the layout for the experiments we did at the lighted areas in Georgia, South Carolina, Florida, and Alexandria and Baton Rouge in Louisiana. So we're looking at 446 entries in maturity groups 0 through 10. And these include 26 North American cultivars. And these were divided the plant introductions or accessions were divided into 4 different tests based on maturity group. So the first test was maturity groups 0 to 1. The second was maturity groups 2 to 4. Third, 5 to 7. And the fourth, 8 to 10. And again, we use these late planting dates also to try and delay maturity and use supplementary lighting in most locations, I think, for about 1 month after planting in order to extend the photo period. So these photos show the test in Quincy, Florida from 2 different angles. Down there we planted 4-foot rows with 6-foot ranges. We're planting about 100 seed on average per row. This is another angle showing the two portable lighting towers that we use there. And so we switch these on at dusk to extend the photo period. The other locations that had no supplementary lighting were in Bossier City and Fairhope, Alabama. And at those sites, we had 293 entries. We excluded the earliest maturity group material. So we're looking at maturity groups 4 to 10. And again, using late planting dates. We're still collecting data from virtually all of these sites, as far as I know. And so I'm going to focus on what we have so far from Quincy. But this is ongoing, and hopefully by the REST meetings next month, we'll have more data to present from the different sites and a better summary of how different plant introductions or accessions are performing in various sites. So in Quincy, Florida, I'm going to focus on that because that's where I was working. We had two replications with 446 entries. These were planted on the 16th and 17th of August. We had the four tests that I mentioned before, divided based on their maturity groups. And we had the early maturity groups planted closer to the light towers, where the light intensity was somewhat stronger. And we ran those lights usually from dusk till 10 p.m. Ideally, we would have liked to run the lights a little bit later in retrospect, but we didn't want to run them all night. And we were using diesel engines, so we didn't want to run those till the fuel ran out. So it was just hard to get somebody to cut them off later than 10 p.m. most nights. That was done for about a month after planting. And the plants were inoculated once with a spore suspension, but there was a field adjacent to the one that the germplasm tests were in that was heavily infected with rust. So I think most of the inoculum actually was blowing in from that field. So in 2006, at most of the sites that were tested last year, the plants were typically rated in the field by going out and walking through using a visual estimate of the disease base, looking at a combination of disease incidence, which would be the frequency of plants in a row that were infected or showing symptoms, disease severity, a lot of times sampling leaves from several of the plants, and in the field just looking at the bottom of the leaves to see approximately what percent of the leaf surface was showing lesions. Also looking at the movement of the disease up through the canopy. Rust typically begins low and moves up to the top. So if you see a lot of disease in the top of the canopy, then you can be pretty sure that you're looking at a highly susceptible plant. And for most of the ratings, they use a scale of 1 to 5 or 1 to 9, where the lower number indicates resistance and less disease. So in Quincy this year, we'd hoped to use that type of rating system, but unfortunately we had an enormous whitefly infestation. And a lot of the leaves in the middle of the canopy that typically would have a large number or density of rust lesions were so encrusted with whitefly debris that we couldn't see enough of the epidermis to really be able to count lesions on those. This photo here is about the limit of what we even tried to count. Even in that, you can see there are a lot of whitefly eggs and cases from where the larvae had hatched out. And so many leaves were much worse than that. And so that forced us to take leaves higher from the canopy than we would have ideally looked at. Also, we felt like in order to rate these fairly, we would have to take the leaf samples to the lab and look at them under a microscope, as opposed to just being able to glance at them out in the field. So that was a problem. Then in late September, I started to notice some wilting in some of the accessions. And within 2 weeks, it went from a few plants here and there to entire rows that had been wiped out entirely. And so we sent Jim Marois, looked at the plants in the field, and Tristan Mueller also. And they weren't quite sure what exactly was killing so many plants. So to confirm that, we sent some samples to the lab. And they determined that The main culprits were Fusarium and Phytophthora, but they also found some Pythium and Rhizoctonia. So it seems like just by chance with the irrigation, there's enough moisture to promote the infections by Phytophthora, but there's enough hot weather and dry conditions to promote the Fusarium infections. So a lot of the plants really got hammered, and you can see that here. This row in the back got hit pretty hard, and you see a few green leaves left in these other rows, but that it messed up our efforts really, especially with the early maturity groups, to try and get leaf samples from all of those before they were killed completely by these soil pathogens. So that forced us to switch to counting lesions and observing sporulation by taking leaf samples to the lab and observing those with a microscope. So the technical term for this measurement, I believe, is infection frequency, where we're looking at the number of pustules or lesions per unit area. And I think of it also as lesion density. We looked at 5 mature leaves that were collected from each row, and we had the microscope set at 20x, and we counted the lesions we saw in a 1 square centimeter area. And then from the 5 leaves that we looked at, we dropped the leaf with the lowest count and calculated a mean from the 4 with the higher counts. And we also noted the presence of sporulation, or whether there was no sporulation occurring, because some leaves had a relatively high spore density but very little sporulation, and others had a somewhat lower density but very heavy sporulation from the lesions that were there. So this is just a photo of the underside of a leaf. I think you can see some of the granular spores emerging from the pustules there. So I'm just presenting a sample of some of the lines that we looked at with cultivar controls, beginning with maturity group 3. We found a few accessions in lower maturity groups look promising, but we haven't counted spores on all the samples we've taken yet, so it's hard for me to recommend specific accessions yet, and this is also just from one location. But this is preliminary data that I'm finding encouraging. This first line is a plant accession, and so Williams 82 is a cultivar, North American cultivar from the same maturity group, and you can see there's quite a difference there. This line is very interesting, L852378, because it's derived from Williams 82, but the RPP1 resistance gene has been backcrossed into it. And you can see the lesion count there is extremely low. The sporulation rating, where 1 is no or very few lesions that are sporulating, and 5 is where virtually all the lesions are sporulating, for this particular line is very low, 1, compared to 5 from Williams 82. Maturity group 5, there are several PIs that I have here that look very interesting in terms of low lesion counts and also low sporulation ratings. And these are compared to 5601T, a cultivar from Tennessee. And these other maturity groups also, 6, 7, and 8, you can see comparisons of some of the promising looking accessions compared to a cultivar from the same maturity group. And some appear to be virtually immune. I don't want to claim that they are yet until we get data from more locations and even from more samples that were taken in Quincy, but certainly they're looking good relative to the cultivars. FT2 is interesting. It's a cultivar from Brazil, and even though the lesion density wasn't as low as for some of the PIs, it was still looking much better than the Benning Czech. So that might be a somewhat elite line that we might be able to get some resistance from more quickly than starting with crosses to a less adapted germplasm. Same thing with Pritchard. There's some that look very good and some that seem to have some moderate amount of resistance at least. This is a photo of two of the germplasm accessions. That one here is resistant, looking very good. It also held up very well to the soil pathogens. And another one here that has some rust symptoms. It's not so promising. But this is an illustration of why I didn't feel like we could rate the plants very accurately in the field, because these three lines all had very low lesion counts, and they all seem to have resistance to rust, but they're showing a lot of symptoms from these soil pathogens and perhaps some other foliar pathogens that we could have easily mistaken for rust just by doing a walkthrough examination. These are some Canadian lines in the background that were wiped out very badly by the soil pathogens. So other considerations that we need to make are resistance to other diseases and pests. These are considerations in choosing which accessions would be good to use in crosses to obtain rust resistance from. So other considerations would be resistance to other diseases and pests, morphology and growth habit. Some of the accessions are very viney and tend to grow horizontally more than upright and have a lot of lodging problems. Parent yield potential. I was taking notes on pod development, how many pods there were relatively on the stems and whether the seeds seem to be relatively large or tiny. Maturity groups, the difference in maturity groups between the resistant parent and potential elite parents that we would make crosses to, it will be easier to identify descendants of those crosses are truly resistant if there's not a wide range of maturity groups between the two parents. But unfortunately, if we want to develop germplasm with resistance for the Midwest, a lot of the most resistant looking plants introductions are in the higher maturity groups. So that could be a challenge down the road to make sure that we're not mistaking maturity for resistance. So the basic breeding and mapping strategies that I'm taking in my program are to cross elite parents with the resistant germplasm, or at least the ones that are apparently resistant, and hopefully resistant in multiple locations and over several years. I'm using a modified single seed descent for some of those populations, but also I think mapping will be very important to identify the locations of resistance genes and tag those with markers. So I'm hoping that we can do some of that with F2-derived F3 families for single genes that affect the lesion type, where reddish-brown lesions are associated with at least moderate resistance, and tan lesions are associated with susceptibility. So if there's a single gene determining the lesion type, then we might be able to do that in earlier generations. But for a lot of mapping work where we're looking at a more quantitative type resistance, we're going to have to look at recombinant inbred lines. So those are going to take longer to develop. But also, those should be useful for breeding purposes as well as mapping. And so marker-assisted selection, I feel like, will be important, especially for developing resistant lines and cultivars for the Midwest and farther north, where rust isn't a persistent annual problem, because that will allow breeders to select in the absence of the pathogen and to combine genes from various sources or to pyramid. So mapping and tagging resistant genes will allow the earlier generation selection, elimination a lot of the material from across that does not have the resistance genes. Selection in the absence of the pathogen, which is especially important in the Midwest, and pyramiding resistance genes, including possibly some of the single resistance genes that have already been mapped, but also with time some of the quantitative resistance genes that we hope to find. And markers can also be used to, DNA markers can also be used to accelerate recovery of the recurrent parent genome in back crosses, and to investigate the relatedness possibly of some of the germplasm accessions that came from the same geographical areas, to make sure that we're not trying to introgress the same genes that from two different accessions. So some of the lessons learned from my experience are that in some cases, like this year, inspection with a microscope is going to be necessary. It's more time consuming, more tedious, but I don't feel like we could have gotten accurate ratings just by walking through the field and giving the accessions a 1 to 5 rating. Lesion number is certainly important. I feel like that's a good indicator of resistance, but also we need to look at the amount of sporulation that's occurring from those lesions. And also, where possible, I think we really need to sample more than once. There were some accessions that we looked at earlier, we collected samples about a month ago, that were looking very promising. And after about 2 weeks, we went back and looked at leaves that we collected at that point, and we saw a lot more lesions or sporulation going on. And there are others that look good at both dates, so it's important to distinguish between those. So I mentioned these people before, but really these people deserve to be co-authors on this presentation. They were heavily involved in conducting the research at different sites, and I hope that this year we'll be able to eliminate a lot of the PIs that truly are susceptible, so that in subsequent years we can focus more time and resources on the PIs that appear to be resistant in multiple locations and years. And I'm sure there are a lot of people at various research stations that helped out a lot, but these are the people that helped me in Florida. David Wright and Jim Marois, who are kind of co-directors of the Rust program there. Tristan Mueller was a big help. He turned the lights on a lot of evenings. Maynard Douglas, he drove the tractor when we were planting those 4-foot rows that were very stressful for me as a person dropping the seed, but very boring for him because had to drop the tractor in about the lowest gear he could find just so that we could keep up with the speed. Kelly O'Brien was a big help. Brian Kidd, the farm, he manages the agronomy research there. Nick Defoe turned the lights off a lot of times for us. Katie Pauls, my technician, collected leaves and counted a lot of lesions. Todd Bedford counted out the seeds and put those in envelopes to send off to the various locations, and that's it.